in certain ways, there is a zero sum game here, or it's presented politically as a zero sum game. So like my inclusion is on the backs of people who are not afforded that degree of inclusion and are relegated to the outsider, kind of forever outsider.
Because you've always taken such charge.
Justo antes del aguacero.
You are listening
to the Border Chronicle.
Are you an inventor?
Welcome to the Border Podcast. I am Todd Miller, who along with my colleague Melissa Delosque, publish articles or pieces or audio, like today's audio, every Tuesday and Thursday at theborderchronicle.com. So please come and visit us there. Today, I am so happy to have with me writer, author, journalist, Lauren Markham, who is the author of A Map of Future Ruins on Borders and Belongings, one of the most insightful books I've read on borders. So, but we're going to get to that in a second. Well, by the way, welcome, Lauren.
Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be here. And thank you for those kind words. That means a lot, especially coming from you. And I'm a huge Border Chronicle fan. So really honored to be here.
Thank you. And Lauren has also written, this is Lauren's second book. She wrote another book called The Faraway Brothers, the making of an two young migrants and the making of an American life. And Lauren is also a very prolific writer and has written many articles in many different magazines. Check out the write-up that we have, and we'll have links to everything. So this book, it's so yeah. Great. It's just a book that has so many layers to it, and it just I'm going to ask you all about it, but I just want to just commend it and recommend it so highly to all of our listeners. It's a book that just keeps the pages turning. It's a book that brings just the best type of storytelling with woven in histories, both personal and global. Mm-hmm. And focusing a lot on what's going on in Europe, especially through Greece, but also, you know, using those stories to give a much, at least I can speak for myself, just such a much better understanding what's happening globally in terms of people on the move in this ever bordered world, bordered and bordering, I guess we should say, world that we live in. But anyhow, Lauren. Just to start, I wanted to just begin maybe with the title, A Map of Future Ruins. To me, that's a very provocative, awesome title. It's right from the start. And on borders and belonging. I know like borders are a big deal, and belonging, you know, the idea of belonging. So if you wanted to maybe talk a little bit about the title to get us started.
Yeah, absolutely. And once again, thank you for your kind words. It means a lot, especially coming from you and who I so admire. A Map of Future Ruins on Borders and Belonging is the title. And I guess I can sort of break it down by components and talk about it, you know, more broadly. Maps are a huge sort of thematic element of this book and almost like a motif in the book. There's a lot of investigation of borders and the nature of borders, and also the changing nature of borders over time and the emergence of, you know, more heavily policed borders and just, you know, enforced borders more generally throughout history. That's, of course, borders are imaginary lines drawn on a map, right? But there's also a focus of sort of placing oneself and finding oneself in place and figuring out where one is on the map. There's a big theme of being lost in this book, of being lost both in stews of ideas and questions, but also being physically lost on the map of the world. I get lost a lot in this book, psychically and physically on the map in some sort of absurdist ways. But of course, becoming lost and being lost is a very common element of people who are crossing borders around the world, right? Because they're trying to evade detection. So there's some element of perilously, like a perilous element of becoming lost on the world map. So that's maps. This is also a book that really is looking at the way, it's a book about storytelling fundamentally, and it's looking at the way that how we narrate the past sort of retrospectively in order to claim or cement some desired future. And so, you know, this sort of nostalgic white supremacy idea of this, you know, we tell these stories backwards about who we once were, and if only we could get back to a more, you know, a more monocultural time, be this in Greece or be this in the United States, then, you know, the future will be brighter. You know, there are obvious political resonances in there that I don't even need to go into in terms of like the upcoming election, et cetera. So
you can, you can go in.
Yeah, I mean, listen, right? I mean, sure, make America great again, right? Like, it's like that is this nostalgic, that is thinking about the future, but it's actually telling a story about the past. That again is key, right? Because it's not just about what we do for the future. It's about saying, let's it's a revivalist and sort of like an, you know, very erasure heavy revivalist instinct. And then Ruins, this is a book, the locus of this book, although it takes place all over the world, the geographic locus of this book is Greece, where there's a, you know, a key, I know we'll talk about it in a second, but a central kind of narrative story of six Afghans who are accused with zero credible evidence against them for a crime in Greece, and looking at migration dynamics in Greece generally. Greece is also a place where my family traces origins, and we have a big mythological origin story from Greece that, you know, has elements of fact in it, and then also elements of not quite imagination, but of valor and grandeur that are maybe not fully matched by reality, like many folks from the Ellis Island generation, I think, many families. And of course, Greece is a place where ruins are central to its idea of itself and its story and its economic, you know, its GDP, the visitors every year. So those are the kind of components of the title. But what I'm sort of trying to evoke in the title, with putting those all those components together, you know, a map of future ruins, it's this notion that if we are to look at the map of the world today and the way, with a focus on borders, and the way our borders are so heavily policed and are being more and more firmly, like these lines in the sand are being, you know, walled. You yourself have written fantastic, but well, books about this. If we are to look at that and project into the future, what we have created is a ruinous map for a ruinous future. Yeah. And, you know, the subtitle is also, it's on borders and belonging, because it's not just about, you know, these lines in the sand. It's also about like where people find place and where people find and are afforded belonging and where they aren't. And this gets back to the sort of Ellis Island generation questions, where, you know, a lot of folks who came in the Ellis Island era were not necessarily afforded belonging early on, and yet, nor were they considered white. And yet I am a full, like my entire life, I have been communicated to by society that I fully belong here and that I am white, which I am. But it's not just a question of borders, but it's also who is afforded belonging and how and on what timeline and by what sort of functions of society and history.
Yeah.
So simple little title.
simple title with so much. Yeah. And trust me, all that, what Lauren just said is all in there in the fluid narration. One of the, to go back to you mentioned the six Afghans and on the trial that they faced, but to go back to that, since it's such a central premise to what you're writing about, could you explain a little bit about them and what happened in Moria in 2020?
Yeah, absolutely. So Moria was the largest refugee camp in Europe. It was widely decried, rightfully, as a human rights graveyard. It was on the island of Lesbos in Greece, which is one of the interestingly, unfortunately named hotspot islands. You know, Europe has essentially externalized its borders to countries like Greece and Italy on the perimeter that tend to, you know, struggle more economically and receive more of the of refugees. And Greece has in turn externalized its borders to these particularly five hotspot islands, Lesbos being the biggest one. And so Moria was built to hold about 2,500 people. It was expanded to hold 3,500 people. At the height of the pandemic, there were about 20,000 people living in Moria. And then by September of 2020, there were about 11,000 people living in the camp. And the camp went up in flames and over the course of 2 days was basically incinerated and charred. It's interesting because no one really wanted Moria there, right? The refugees didn't want to live there because it was an incredibly squalid place, especially for being in a very highly resourced economic zone like the EU. You know, rat infestations, incredibly overpacked quarters, limited food and supplies, you know, 500 people sharing a toilet, et cetera. And so the refugees didn't want it. Human rights workers and kind of the left widely decried the camp and protested it. But also the right wing didn't want it either, because it's like, get these refugees off our island. Why are we housing them here? So sort of no one was happy with this camp, and yet it existed and grew and swelled. And, you know, and this is both a fact and also kind of a potent metaphor to me. It went up in flames. And within a couple of days, like, and, you know, someone needed to pay for this, because along with that went a ton of olive groves and just went this like infrastructure. Refugees were living for over a week, just kind of marooned on the stretch of road. They weren't allowed to move from it. There was very few amenities. And within a couple of days, six young Afghans were arrested for the crime of arson based on the very, 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 I won't go into it, but dubious testimony of a single eyewitness who has never showed up to a trial and cannot be found. And they were sentenced to 10 years in prison for that crime. So I write about that because it's a remarkable story of cruelty. And also one that reveals the necessity of refugee hosting or migration hosting kind of destination countries to paint the profile of a refugee or of a migrant as one of a criminal. And so, you know, to punish them for being refugees in the first place.
Yeah. Thanks. We'll probably come back to that story as we talk. Yeah. I wanted to ask as well about, you write a lot about, from the get-go and throughout the book, along with the Moria stories, there's a numbers of layers, right? And one of them definitely is the mythology and myth and myth making. Yeah. And I have a quote. I have my notes of your book are written like a mad scientist.
Nice. But, that brings me much delight.
Yeah. But right off the bat, you bring in myth and mythology, and you say, you know, as a journalist, you are going, and I'm paraphrasing you now, because in my mad scientist notes, I cannot find the, but you say that you're going to confront, you know, as a journalist, you're going to confront the myths head on. And right after that, then you go on to write this extremely insightful, you know, then about the myth of the West, you know, how we say the West and the West this and the West that. And West, right? And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that and I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about the myth of the West, but also just how myth has this idea is just so strong, a potent force in your book.
Yeah. It's funny because I hear like the myth of the West, and I think the other side of my family is like fifth generation Californian. So like the other side of the non-Greek side of my family, it's all about the myth of the West as in the myth of westward expansion in the United States. But of course here, so it's like, I got multiple, I'm like, oh, that might, you know, maybe that's the next book. We're talking here, right, about the myth of Western civilization and the idea of like the West as opposed to, you know, the East or the global North versus the global South, like these sort of faulty geographic designations. I definitely did go into journalism with this idealism that I still hold, even if I have lots of questions around the how and questions that I think, you know, in any vocation, we should be holding these questions at the center of what we do and why we do it and like how to keep doing it as, you know, ethically and honestly and with greatest effect that we can. which I feel like is, like, to me, the project of the Border Chronicle and why I'm such an admirer. But, you know, I went into journalism to face and sort of take down myths, right? Myths of the immigrant as criminal, myths as the immigrant of drain on society, myths as the myth of the sort of necessity of fortified borders, of the necessity of immigration detention. And so there's, like, sort of that element of myth, of course, because the central locus of this book is Greece. There's the sort of canonical myths. So, you know, because the locus of this book is Greece, there's the question of these canonical myths, you know, the Greek myths that we all had to read in grade school and probably college and high school. And I find those myths and that mythological system fascinating. But within and connected to that, to how central those myths have become, like why we read Greek myths in the United States and throughout Europe and honestly throughout the world, like even the Afghan kids that I was interviewing for this book, you know, who were imprisoned, like they also had been exposed to these myths from Afghanistan. And the reason that those are so central and canonical as like in a way that we don't read, you know, myths from East Asia or from West Africa or from, you know, like the Mayan civilization, as fascinating and potent as those mythologies are, it has to do with this mythology of Western civilization and this idea that A, that even exists, and B, that Greece is the birthplace of that, that civilization and that democracy and that the sort of Western identity, right? European, US, American, basically white identity traces roots back to Greece. And while of course there's some sort of civilizational inheritance there, it's certainly, as the great writer and thinker Kwame Appiah said, that it is not, you know, he has an amazing quote about, like, it's rendered as if it was this golden nugget that is, like, directly descended, you know, from whatever, you know, Plato all the way to today. And that just is factually not true. You know, there are hundreds, thousands of years between then and now where Greece has been other things and where other influences have played out all throughout, you know, what we erroneously, I think of as the West. And the troubling part of this is that Greece, that idea of Greece and that idea of ancient civilization has been instrumentalized by white supremacists all over the world. This idea that white people are superior because look at, you know, where we can, like, look at ancient Greece. That is where democracy was born. That is where civilization first began. This is, of course, all false. But if you take that as truth and you take the sort of precious golden nugget idea of there has been a direct lineage, then you can create a new layer of mythology, which is that white people are superior and white civilization is superior, which is then a potent mythology to further exclude in contemporary times. So the layers of mythology are really interesting to me because I do think, like I said, this is fundamentally a book about storytelling. And I do think that the way we tell stories determines the policies that we make and the way we understand the world, right? The way we tell stories about the past determines how we cement our future. And so these pernicious mythologies are should trouble us all, and we should be paying attention to them.
Yeah, that makes me think of it, just because you made the comment earlier about the half of your family that's from California and the westward expansion. Yeah. And it's so interesting to think of, like, Manifest Destiny as a myth too, and how there's this, like, civilizing, you know, the civilizing was such a central core to that, of Manifest Destiny. And then to think of how idea of civilization going back to Greece and or at least in the sort of myth making aspect of it. And which makes me too, like, I wanted to ask you about maps, and I know you brought up maps right at the very beginning, but I wanted to go a little bit deeper into it along in the spirit. But you have this quote, and it's and it goes into kind of what you were just saying, like about the mythology of even of borders, right? And you write, a border like whiteness, like the state, is a fiction of grave consequences. It's an imaginary absolute that bisects a landscape, turning terrain into territory, the border, the most tyrannical line of all. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, looking at maps, like I said, looking at cartography, looking at the way kind of countries were, you know, terrain became territory, countries were sort of carved up into nation states. You know, if we look at some of the countries that have the most people fleeing today, tend to, if you trace back to how their map was drawn, tend not to have self-determined that line, right? That line tends to have been projected upon them, enforced upon them, insisted upon them, drawn by outsiders. And that's certainly true of Afghanistan. I write about that history. You know, it's true throughout the Americas, right? So that's really interesting to me, this idea that borders are made up, that the nation state is made up, and yet it's a fiction of very grave consequence. It's a made up thing that matters because we've decided that it matters. Kind of like, you know, money. That's not real. It's just a green piece of paper. Like the dollar is just a green piece of paper, and yet you need it to live in this world. Like, and I'm not saying that we need borders to live in this world, but like, if you live in this world, you are affected by borders. And so I think, yeah, that element of cartography was really fascinating to me. Has always been really fascinating to me. And it feels like we need to be thinking about not just what borders are and how they operate, but how they came to be in the first place, if we're to sort of imagine into a future that isn't, you know, entirely determined by policed borders, which is a future that frankly will come for every single one of us, you know, like no one is safe in that future. Some of us are safer for longer, but yeah.
Yeah. And like along, also piggybacking off that, you know, there's what you described about being lost. And when I think about borders and think about the kind of deterrence strategy you see on so many borders around the world and how that forces people into places where they are essentially lost. Right. And you have, as you write, and you, it's many places in the book where you yourself feel lost, right? And there's there's one particularly riveting scene on your grandmother's island, right? Your grandmother's island, where your grandmother's from. What's the name of the island again?
It's called Andros. I think actually this, there, I definitely got lost a lot on that island. And then there's one really, like, we got very kind of scarily lost on the island of Hedra.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it's probably.
There's lots of islands in Greece.
The Hedra, yeah, of course. Sorry.
Yeah. No.
But that scene it reminded me of stories that I've heard of people being lost as they try to navigate borders, right? And the no water, having no water, being like not knowing which way was which, and very riveting how it was written. And then all the stuff, you know, like spiders coming out of the trees I think of the Darien Gap, you know, as one place. It made me think of something that you wrote earlier in the piece, that you, you know, when you're on the move, a person on the move, sometimes you have to be just lost enough to save your life. And I don't know, like thinking about people on the move all around the world, and you did write about people being on the move, not only going to Greece, but all around the world. I wondered if you could reflect on that a little bit.
Yeah, totally. So the story is that on the island of Hedra, thinking that we were just like having a vacation walk and like going to go to some beaches and take a little hike and then, you know, end the day at a fancy restaurant and another beach and go home, we got like very scarily lost in like 103 degree weather with no shade, no water. There's a mythological overlay here because, as you said, all of these sort of eerie things started happening, you know, like disappearing roads and spiders appearing out of nowhere and like losing one another, even though we were right near one another and calling for each other. So there was some element, like sort of mystic, sinister, mystical element to what was happening. And certainly when I was in that circumstance, I was thinking a lot about all the stories that I'd heard of people being lost, you know, in the desert, particularly, you know, between the United States and Mexico, also in the Darien Gap, although, you know, the desert was because it was so hot and there was no water, I was particularly thinking of that. But I want to be really, also really clear that, like, part of what I am tangling with in the book and that I'm very aware of throughout this book and in this conversation too, is to not make any false equivalencies between, like, you know, some vacation hike and people fleeing for their lives through perilous territory and being funneled into that perilous territory because of borders, right? There are other places to cross, but the folks cross in the most perilous, you know, terrain because that's where they're pushed toward on purpose. So, I mean, I don't want to create a false equivalency there, but it is a moment of reflection in the book of just thinking about the being in that psychic state of being lost and how overwhelming and scary that was, even though the stakes were so low for me, you know? So that's part of it. And that maps to and mirrors, like, the overall project of this book, which is not to say, oh, I had family who immigrated to Ellis Island and didn't have the easiest time of it. That's totally like forced migrants today, because it's not. In fact, the project of the book is to show just how different those experiences were and how, thanks to proximity to whiteness and then eventual inclusion in whiteness, thanks to, you know, the time periods and the various things that came after, my family has been afforded belonging. My family has been afforded opportunity and inclusion, not just like while other people haven't, but like in certain ways there is a zero sum game here, or it's presented politically as a zero sum game. So like, my inclusion is on the backs of people who are not afforded that degree of inclusion and are relegated to the outsider, kind of forever outsider.
Would you say that would it be fair to say that there's a sort of myth of belonging in that sense? Yeah. Not that like you have to sort people whether they belong or not, but there's a sort of potential myth of belonging. Or a myth making that goes along with why I belong and then why somebody else might not belong. That's what I should say.
Totally. That is what's so interesting to me about, you know, members of my family and I think other of the Ellis Island generation, of this idea of like, the great writer T. Bui sort of talks about it as like, you know, pulling the ladder up behind you kind of deal. It's like, we're in, we made it, but not you, you know? And that's what I mean by there's like an expense there. There's a sort of like, because belonging in this country has always been so precarious, I think that lends itself to a fear of you know, precarity equals fear, right? That you're going to lose it. And so I think that on a often subliminal and subtle level, but it matters, and is made very evident. I think there's this idea of like, well, if I'm in, then other people need to remain out, right? Like any inside presupposes an outside. And yeah, with the precarity of belonging, I think a unfortunate human tendency can be to exclude in order to like affirm and confirm one's belonging as an insider.
Yeah, and I was also thinking, you know, in terms of your, you know, following your grandmother's story, which I personally found to be it's very touching. Like anything that has to do with people's grandparents.
Yeah.
And for one of my books, I actually went to my grandmother's. It made me think of, I didn't go into the story like you did in this book, but in one of my books, one of my grandmothers from Marinduque in the Philippines, and I went to that island. It was a book on climate change and on displacement.
Okay, yeah, I'm like trying to remember which book this is. Okay.
The book Storming the Wall. And I remember like being on her island for the first time. And when I was reading your writing about going to the island of, I was wondering to your grandmother's island in Greece. I was wondering, I never can remember the name. Can you tell me the name?
It's, yeah, no problem. It's Andros. Andros.
Andros.
Is the island. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, when I was there, it was a whole different, another era as well when my my grandmother left and migrated from there. But I remember being just so profoundly moved that I was at the same place that I was of my grandmother. And I went looking for her house and any sort of relatives. And we ended up in the backyard and a bunch of women were playing poker, you know, because they're following our surname.
I love it.
You know, it's very, it's, but it really like that, that's sort of, for me, a lot of depth that I was trying to cover, because at the same time, her in her case, her island was getting sea level rise was very much impacting it, and it was becoming more. But I was wondering, in your case, you know, that that sort of, I know that they're different stories, the Ellis Island story versus what's going on now, but there's there's commonalities as well of people having to leave, especially because of. Of, you know, if you're poor, you know, or you can't make ends meet. And I'm wondering, like, was that, for me, like, reading that in your book brought even more, you have so many layers of depth in it, and that that brought this, like, even more profound layer of depth. But I wanted to know from your your perspective.
Yeah, that means a lot. I mean, I think that that is one of the projects of this book, is to look at migration as, like, you know, over time. Because one of the things, you know, part of this book is myself having a crisis, you know, having a crisis in journalism and in my profession, while also kind of recommitting to it and feeling its vital place in the world and in justice movements. But one of the things that journalism can do, or bad journalism, it's trying to tell the story, and editors sometimes want this, of like, this is why this thing has never happened before, right? Here's what we're seeing at the border now that's unprecedented. And I think that what I was sort of trying to do, or what I was trying to do, is actually show the long, long, long history in this country of both immigration exclusions, kind of in terms of policy and in terms of their felt impact on individuals and families. And I think I'm so glad, you know, when we're talking about belonging, that you brought up this question of sort of this yearning for homeland, because I think that's another really interesting thing, is that those of us who may have, you know, intentionally or unintentionally, with awareness or without awareness, pulled up the ladder behind us, as you know, people who sort of are afforded citizenship and other forms of belonging in this country, be that whiteness or white passingness or resources, opportunities, what have you, I think that there's that simultaneously a lot of those folks, myself and my family included, also have this feeling that there's this far off place where that we actually belong to, even if we've never been there before, even if we don't speak the language, even if we don't really know anything about that place. And I think that that speaks to this complexity of identity with regard to place and how we place ourselves on the world map and how we tell the story of self. And, you know, any kind of migration is a cleaving between where we are now and where we once were. And even if that's happened over generations, I think it's very common for people to feel like, you know, I mean, I'll speak for myself. Like, I always was raised, and I talk about this in the book, with this idea that I am Greek, even though I never went to Greece until I was 2019. I don't speak the language. You know, I have no connection to Greece, except for that I have a profound connection there. So some of the work of the book is investigating that impulse. And it's like, where does that come from? And where is that sort of like, kind of a sweet, lovely human impulse? And where does that kind of, where is the line where it begins to mutate into exclusion or into appropriation? And then it's also, I mean, in the book, you know, the narrator is really wrestling with, what does it mean that this place means something to me, even though I know nothing about it? Like, what is that? And what does that say about humans' desire to belong somewhere and to locate ourselves on the map and to tell stories about who we are via where we come from?
Yeah. And that, brings me probably, I guess we're at the end of our time here, so I'm gonna wrap up. But I wanted to end with, you have really insightful writing on journalism and what journalism is. And I mean, really, gosh, I mean, I have to say, I connected so much with so much of what you're writing about, like on many times throughout the whole book. And this is just one other example of it. But the way that you wrote about something I just think a lot about now, I think a lot about the way that we're kind of the edit, like you just mentioned, editors will have you write about a story, an immigration story or a border story, and how they have to follow a certain path or a certain you have to say certain things. And oftentimes when you write this, and I wish I had the quote in front of me because it's so good, but you miss some of the most telling moments about that say so much, but don't cut by an editor or and for example, you and one you're talking about some reporting that you did in the Daring Gap, and and you're interviewing a person who, you know, survived walking through the Darien Gap and who's telling their story. And they have, there's another like kind of sub story of a woman who just sat on the ground and said, I'm not moving another inch. I'm not going to go any further. Just leave me here. Yeah. And everyone, they have tried for hours to tell her to go, but she wouldn't budge. And you said that you included that in your original story, but then that it was kind of edited out.
Yeah.
But that was an example of something that, because it turns out, right, you can tell the story yourself, but it turns out that maybe she didn't die, right? Yeah. And there's this story that's alive, and it's a part of mythology. Is it true? Is it what? It's there, right? It's a story.
Right.
And it's a part, it's and what I'm getting at is that there's so much more than the flattened down characters that we often get when we hear, you know, tales of people on the move. And you not only do that in this book, I mean, you get very rounded out characters that are very human, they're human beings, right? And then you then are able to articulate in how journalism kind of squashes that, but then you reclaim it. And I really like it. And one last quote, and then I'll let you talk about this. But you say after about the woman in the Daring Gap, you said the tales we tell each other can serve as oracles, yes. And then really sweetly, and as medicine too. Mm. And that medicine part really just, I mean, it just touched my heart.
That means so much. Yeah, that was such an interesting piece. And on the one hand, like a piece of this story that, right, like there's this, the idea, the story goes, and I heard this from multiple people at the time that, you know, and it's a story that they had heard. So they weren't with this woman, but yeah, there was a woman and she couldn't go any further in the Darien Gap. And so she just sat down and waited to die. But then it turns out she didn't die. She stayed alive and she foraged for food. And what she would do is sometimes she'd leave food out for other migrants who were passing through. And sometimes she was a trickster kind of spirit who would steal the food. So, you know, you'd go into your backpack knowing you had one thing of crackers left and it was gone, you know? And so she became this kind of mythological character. Had she existed in the first place, who knows? But she kind of became this like almost mythological spirit, right? In this place. And I think anytime there's this story that's repeated, regardless if it's true or not, it's like, well, what is that story serving to these people? And I think my interpretation of it, which, you know, anyone can have their own, one way that I sort of came to look at it was like, it was helpful for these people who were risking their lives and coming very close to death to have this, the idea that someone had done that, stayed put and survived, and that there was almost like a force watching over them, you know, who could both help them, but also sort of explain when something went awry, you know, when a small thing went awry. And I understand why that doesn't end up in like a magazine piece, because it's not fact checkable. It's not like real, you know, in the sense that like, you know, I mean, it could be very, very, very real, but like, it's not fact checkable. It doesn't end up on the list of facts. And we have to be really careful here when we talk about journalism, because, you know, we can edge really closely in this conversation into the like, and what do facts matter? If we feel that it's true, it can be true. And that's, you know, that's Kellyanne Conway, you know, neocon special sauce, or not even neocon, whatever the, you know, the terrifying far right special sauce, is like, you know, what are facts, however we feel about things make it true. And so that is not the contour of this question that interests me, but I do wonder how much we afford to felt reality when we are talking about people in vulnerable circumstances, as opposed to merely like as you know, outsider writers and editors, the facts of their lives that seem most interesting and relevant to us.
Yeah, that's definitely what I, you know, what I came across reading here. I definitely don't get the Kellyanne Conway.
Yeah, I think I was careful to not do that. You know, but I just, in this conversation, I want to make sure that readers aren't taking away, like, you know, Lauren and Todd don't think facts are good in journalism.
No. But I mean, I have to say, I resonate with the idea that so often, like, people are just, you know, people on the move are just, you know, flattened, or they're just portrayed as victims, or the kind of full humanness, the full stories, the all those different little details are often left out. Anyhow, Lauren, do you have anything else you would like to say?
Well, I just wanted to say, I mean, it's like, you know, when you write, this is there's certain elements of risk in this book, because it's trying to do something different than what I have written before and read, and so it's just a beautiful experience to be read by you and have this book met by you, so thank you so much.
Oh gosh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for writing this book, really. I hope to do more with it, actually. Where can people find it? By the way, this will all be in the write-up as well, so you can click on it, but can you just say it verbally?
You can find it anywhere. I recommend going to your local bookshop and either finding it there or ordering it. But it's available anywhere. There's an excerpt if you want to check it out up on LitHub, and another one at the LA Review of Books. May this book find its readers, and may you be one of these readers.
Great. And you, do you have a website, Lauren?
Oh, yeah, sorry. It's laurenmarkham.info. So a lot of my writing is up there, and info about the book and upcoming events, et cetera, are up there.
Great. We'll have that. We'll have all that in the write-up. Thanks again, Lauren, for spending this time. Lauren is about to head off for some book events. So she cleared a little space in her very busy life to do this. So I'm very grateful for that, and grateful for your book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Todd. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Border Chronicle podcast. The Border Chronicle is reported by Todd Miller and Melissa Del Bosque, based in Tucson, Arizona. This episode was edited by me, Steve Heiss. If you like what you're hearing, please consider rating us on your favorite podcast platform. It will help other people find the show. You can read and listen to more local border journalism on our website, thebordercchronicle.com.